Alcoholic. My home group is Fifth Tradition Group here in Atlanta, and my sobriety date is April 10th, 2001. And I want to welcome everybody to the afternoon AA workshop. And it's great to see so many people here for the AA workshop. You know, there's a number of people that come to speaker meetings, but the people that come to the workshops, you know, they're really interested in their sobriety, and we've got a great afternoon for you. But before I do that, I've got a couple announcements, and then we'll have the serenity prayer. Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I've had a chance to visit with Sandy and talk about a variety of things. I'm excited about what he has to share with us this afternoon. And so without any further ado, I'm going to turn over the meeting to Sandy B. from Tampa. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I've been to this before. AA in Atlanta is really great. All of Georgia, the Georgia Prepaid Convention, I've been there several times, and what a wonderful idea. So that everybody can attend. It's unique, I think. I don't know. Have we got them out in California? No, I haven't. No, it's a great idea. I didn't know if I was going to make it or not. I've been having a few health problems, and I know that I am going around on that walker, and a couple times I was really abrupt to a couple people who wanted to talk. And I needed to go lie down, so I apologize. I feel bad about it after I do something like that. But selfishness sets in, and what the hell are you going to do about it? You just make amends later. That's about all I know. I enjoy seeing my friend Ralph. I guess I've been traveling around about 40 years. And you get to know some of the other speakers. And I know the first time I met Clancy when he came up to Washington to talk, you know, I had like a year and he had 6 years or whatever it is, and it seems like night and day, you know, like you're such a brand newcomer and here's this old timer. But when you get 45 years later, it doesn't seem as much, if you follow what I say. And I've really enjoyed learning from him. He's one of the speakers that showed me that the best way to communicate about spirituality is through stories, because it can't be done directly. It's just you cannot talk about spirituality like you can mathematics or science. You know, you just can lay it out. And the best way to explain it is through stories. And I remember, you know, his invisible boat and all those things that Clancy has used. And they really pay off. So I was thinking about our topic today, the spiritual life is not a theory. You have to live it. What does that mean? It means it can't be explained. That's what it means. The spirit, it's not a theory. You can't explain it. You have to experience it. And it's very important to understand that. The best example, if you're new, and I'm sure you've run into this, you've been coming around AA for 6 or 7 months, and your friends notice the difference. And they're very attracted to it. You're a different guy or a different gal, and they're going, you know, Mary, what do you happen? You look, you on a diet, or you look 10 years younger, you look so wonderful, you know, what's going on? Oh, I joined AA, and it just transformed my whole life. Really? What do you do? What do you do that makes you look like this? We attend meetings. Really? What do you do at a meeting? Oh, I was at one last night. It's my home group. It's a discussion meeting. We had a wonderful lady come in from up the way, and she led us on the topic of resentment. And we went around the room and talked about resentment, and then we said the Lord's Prayer, and we went home. Would you like to come? I mean, you know, you explained it. That's exactly what happened there. But in order for her friend to understand, she would actually have to attend a meeting. And then after she sat through it and watched all the dynamics of what happened there, then they would understand it. Because it was done through experience. And so this sentence, the spiritual life is not a theory. Bill has several of these throughout our literature. We're in the middle of something, he'll just suddenly make a big point. You know what I mean? God is everything or he's nothing. And it doesn't necessarily flow with the traffic, but it is a very important point. Sometimes it's italicized and other times it isn't. And I love those things because they must have been important to him. He must have felt that this is an opportunity to put something powerful in here in the middle of the ninth step. And when you think about that step, the fifth step and the ninth step, I mean, this is where you're dealing with other people. I mean, you've got to go talk to your sponsor about all the stuff in the fourth step. And then here we're out there actually making amends and seeing other people and experiencing different reactions to our amends. Sometimes the people accept what we're doing and other times they just call us a jerk and tell us to never come back. But it doesn't matter because we finished our assignment. We have cleaned off our side of the street, and we can move on. So you can see these steps that involve other people really do produce results. And, you know, there's a bunch of promises in the fifth step, and certainly the ones that are most quoted are in the ninth step. And while I'm talking about that, I talked to some, it's hard to believe that everything in AA wasn't always here. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, when I got sober, you didn't say hi back to the speaker. The guy said, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. Everybody just stayed quiet. And then some people in California, where else, they started going, well, let's say hi to each other. And so it's sweeping across the country, and I guess I had about 4 years, and it got to Washington, D.C., and now we started saying hello to each other. And I never thought anything about it. I just said, well, I guess we're saying hello to each other. I wasn't curious like I am now. And a few months later, I went to Boston to a meeting, and it hadn't gotten there yet. You know who was the only one in the room? Hey, Ralph! And, so they all looked at me funny, and I said, it's coming, don't worry. You guys will be doing it soon. And, of course, down in Boston, they say hi. And we didn't hold hands during the Lord's Prayer for about 5 years. And then the guy next to me grabbed my hand one night, and I went, hey, what the hell's going on here? That came from California. And the way we started meetings, we didn't have any format typed up because you didn't need it. All groups started the meeting the same way. You got up. You welcomed everybody to your group. You asked them to join you in the Serenity Prayer. You read the preamble and you introduced the speaker. It took about 3 minutes to do the whole thing. Then somebody decided we ought to read chapter 5. I'm not going to tell you where it came from. And then there was a reading the long form of the traditions, and then they're going to do this, and it, you know, and some of us are going, what the hell's going on? It's taking 15 minutes before we start the meeting with all these readings. And my friend Hal Marley and I and a couple other people were going to play a joke on Clancy one time when he came to Washington. We were going to read until he broke. You follow what I'm saying? And it's also the custom of this group to read the chapter to the agnostic. But we never pulled it off. I wish that, God, I wish I had been there to see that. You know, how much are you going to read? Now, the reason I'm back is, and there were no promises. That was what led me into this thing. In other words, if you had asked somebody, what are the promises, there was, I haven't got a clue. And then somebody noticed them. You know what I mean? Said, aren't these extravagant promises? And they said, wow, there's some promises here. And of course, if you think about it, any sentence with will in it is a promise. You know what I mean? You will know this and you will. And of course, the final promise will never come true. You will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. They're all dead. You're not going to meet any of them, so... That promise is not going to come true, and don't expect it. So anyway, the next thing, they're on plastic. And once they're on plastic, they're officially part of AA. You know, when you got the promises as a bookmark in your book, they have arrived. Well, that wasn't enough, so then there's the fifth step and the fourth step and the third, you know, there's just everywhere. And we have a guy in one of my groups, and they'll go, Jerry, why don't you close the meeting with one of the promises? And he'll forget obscure things from Bill's story or somewhere like that and read a sentence with will in it. And that'll be the promise. So I don't know what got me going on that. It just, it's just funny how things happen and catch on. I know a lot of, they're trying to uncatch on adding all this stuff at the end of things, you know, where you, who's large and in charge and drives a barge and got us all to the meeting and those things. They were fun, but I think they're starting to fade out, which is probably good. So, I think I was talking about, a spiritual principle. The spiritual life is not a theory. I like the fact that it's in the ninth step. It's a great place to start as a reference point if you're looking at our program. Because we do encounter the promises that we read at almost all the meetings at the end of this step. And the if you're new, just look at the verbs that are used in these promises. Self-seeking will slip away. I mean, that's not a psychiatric term. You wouldn't go to a therapist and say, don't worry, three sessions and self-seeking will slip away. And I'll send you a bill. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. Just, you're not even looking, and it's just, it goes. In other words, these are not verbs that you use in a normal way. They are magic. That's what it is. It's the verbs of a something beyond human power. And that's why I like them. And then, of course, it wraps up with, they will always Materialize. Oh, now, isn't that a great verb? Materialize out of nothing. They just, and here they are. So what are we describing? We're describing something that can't be explained. It either materializes for you or it hasn't yet, but it will if you work for it. So it will always materialize if you work for it. And then comes a wonderful description of a spiritual awakening. We suddenly realize that God's doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. So anytime you have a sudden realization of God, that's a very powerful personal experience. And you've either had it or you haven't. But you know people that have. And I tell the people I sponsor the first day, I said, you will have a spiritual awakening. That is a guarantee, so don't even worry about it. And I think the fact that they're expecting it makes it even more likely that they'll recognize it and that this is the point of it all. You know, it's like trying to talk somebody into drinking, if you ever had to do that. You will have a good time. You will. All of that, you know. And I'm sure there were people who just never drank for whatever reason who to this day feel that it's vastly overrated and it wouldn't have done all those things. Two people at a high school dance, and one of them said, you don't know how to dance? Well, drink this. And you will know how to dance. You'll be on the dance floor within 15 minutes, especially if you have three. You will know how to dance. Implying that there are dance lessons contained in the glass of alcohol. And what happens when the person drinks it? One, two, three. Hey, I'm out there. They're not doing a very good job, but they're having a hell of a good time. And as far as they're concerned, they're dancing. Now, if someone didn't ever drink, and you ask them 20 years later, do you think had you had that drink, you would have known how to dance? They'd go, no, you can't put dance lessons in a glass and you would know how to drink, how to dance. So the same thing happens with spirituality. It has either happened or it hasn't. And so we learn about it, but that's not the point of it, to learn about it. But you can't help learning about it because we talk about it all the time. And we have steps and we have wonderful literature. But the moment we're all talking about is we suddenly realize that there is this thing called my creator, and I am in contact with this creator at this second. It's now the theory's gone. There's no theory, there's no faith, there's no hope, there's certainty. And there's a big difference between that. You know, in the page 25, wherever it is in the very beginning, the absolute certainty that our creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed magnificent, or whatever that sentence is. Certainty. Well, a spiritual experience is certain. In other words, it's real. It happens to you, and after it happens, you aren't the same person. You have now been contacted. And to me, that's the difference between the churches that I attended and AA. The churches, I learned a lot about God, but I never experienced contact. There were people that did, I just didn't. And as a matter of fact, AA probably has, percentage-wise, without doubt, has to be the organization with the highest percentage of people who have contact with their creator. And you wonder, gee, isn't that amazing? Why are we so far ahead of every other organization? There's no other organization that's even close. We corner the market on desperate people. Our cross-section, our sampling of members is 100% desperate, whereas the church, there's some few desperate here and there, but a lot of them are just there because they enjoy it and their lives are going well. They want to get closer to God. There's many, many reasons, but their level of desperation is nowhere near an alcoholic hitting his or her bottom. And as William James, in that wonderful book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, points out, this phenomenon of spiritual transformation, all the ones he studied in preparation for those lectures that he gave, occurred to people who were desperate. They didn't occur to people who were doing well. And these, not just alcoholics, these are people who were suicidal, something awful happened in their family, whatever it was. And in the midst of that, they were transformed. And as he looked at religion in general, he felt that these transformed people were the most important result of religion that there was. That this was one of the great gifts to society, are people who've been transformed. And that's why AA offers so much to society, because they are bringing a new energy into the workplace where you work and where you live and your neighborhood and all of that. This energy that comes out of a transformation is very comforting to people who experience it. And I'm, you know, even when you were growing up, there were certain neighbors or places where you went, maybe down the grocery store, there were certain people that you really liked being near. You felt safe. You felt there's something about them that just makes me feel wonderful. And of all the people that are being transformed into that are the alcoholics who the society couldn't stand. We were the last people anybody wanted to be around for comfort and peace of mind. And yet, a few years in AA, and suddenly we find that people enjoy very much being around our energy. I noticed after 15 years or so that when I went into a store that I frequented on a regular basis, I was always greeted with the biggest smile. They were glad to see me. I could see they were really glad to see me. And I realized it's because I was glad to see them. I was happy to go in and see this person. And maybe it was a dry cleaner. And maybe I had dropped my suit off to be cleaned up for my daughter's wedding. And I came to pick it up and it wasn't ready. And it's not the clerk's fault. And you know what they're feeling. Because most people who in those circumstances are going to really let them have it. And instead we go, oh, don't worry, I got another suit. And we take them off the hook. And they never forget it. They never forget that they were treated in a very loving way, the way we would like to be treated, because of this program. It's a great thing, you know, and as we do this, we are changing the world that we live in. If everywhere we went, we were able, we can't do it all the time, but if we do it fairly regularly, we are bringing out the best in the people we have contact with. And so we go walking around during the day, and everywhere you go, they're smiling back. We're going, yeah, good to see you, good to see you. You know, and you come home and you go, man, this is a hell of a nice world that I live in. All these people, blah, blah, blah. And compare that to 15 years earlier when our specialty was bringing out the worst in people. You know what I mean? Which, as practicing alcoholics, we drove them crazy. And they responded. often with anger, with distrust, with just all these things. So as we went through the day, the world we lived in was no fun at all. And so you might as well drink more in order to get along. Anybody who lives in this kind of a world, with all this hostility, where everywhere I go, people can't stand me. No wonder I drank. If they'd just straighten out, I wouldn't have to drink as much as I do. But for whatever reason, they're all behaving this way, this conflict. And I have no idea that I am the reason they're behaving that way. That's a very powerful thing to find out, that you can transform the world you live in by being transformed here in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is what is being discussed in that. Spiritual life is not a theory. Then comes the exciting part. When they finish the promises, if you recall, two or three sentences later, it makes the announcement in the tenth step that we've entered the world of the Spirit. Now, what a nice sentence that is. We've entered the world of the Spirit. So you can say, well, that's just a figure of speech. Or you can say, no, that's literal. He doesn't mean that as a figure of speech. He means literally we have entered the world of the Spirit. And so what does that mean? Well, look at the promises. You remember they had all the magic verbs in them? They're always materialized. We suddenly realize that God is doing for them. The world of the Spirit is everything in that world is connected to God. It's almost like you enter the world of alcoholism. It all involves drinking. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's not a complicated world. Just get a bottle and drink, and you're in. There are a lot of people who can't drink like we did. And, and maybe they'd like to become an alcoholic, and we're coaching them. And they're going, look, I got to take a day off. My stomach, I'm throwing up. No days off. If you want to become an alcoholic, you just drink, throw it up, and then it'll stay down. Eventually, it'll stay down. Come on. You want to become an alcoholic or not? I mean, what? See what I mean? There's no middle ground. More. Now you're getting the hang of it. Now you're getting there. Maybe. So this is the world we're talking about. We're entering the world of the Spirit, which means we're never not in contact with God. So that's a new thing we're going to have to learn, is how to constantly remind ourselves to stay in contact with God. No sneaking self-sufficiency in. I know when nobody's looking, you like to go, I'll do this myself, I don't need God's help. That's called leaving the world of the Spirit and going somewhere else. So it starts out and it says, whenever we're disturbed, resentful, whatever, I can't quote the whole thing, we ask God at once to remove him. So here's some basic instructions on how to live in the world of the Spirit. As soon as I'm upset, as soon as I have this, I ask God at once to remove it. So you go to, in order to check out, if we're living in the world of the Spirit, we follow the alcoholic to a discussion meeting. And we listen to their answer to how do you deal with impatience. Do you ever go there where there's a topic is how do you deal with impatience? How many answers say, I just ask God for patience? zero, right? Well, I'll tell you what I do when I'm dealing, trying to become more patient. I try to think about the other people. I try to put myself in their shoes. I try to do-do-do-do-do-do-da-da-da. And I have a whole plan that leaves God out. You know it, you do it, and I do it. My ego wants to be creative and come up with, how do I develop patience? How do I develop tolerance? And you don't hear the word God in there, because the ego loves to solve problems and leave God out. And so when we're talking about the world of the Spirit, it's calling ourselves up short on a constant basis to say the word God as we're talking to ourselves, as we're talking to other people. I like to involve God. God can give me this. Walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Isn't that a beautiful sentence? Walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Can you picture yourself walking hand in hand? Or do you have misgivings about that? And you go back to grammar school days when somebody was picking on you, so your big brother walked you to school. You remember that? And the other people, oh, your big brother has to walk you to school. So walking hand in hand with a big brother is a sissy thing. Maybe walking hand in hand with God is kind of a sissy thing. Do you see what I'm talking about? It's like, yeah, I'm walking hand in hand, but I'm not going to tell anybody. Because I want them to think I can make it through life on my own. Because that's what my father told me to do, and that's what everybody told me to do. You got to make it through life on your own. Well, maybe that's not true. If you're going to enter the world of the Spirit, you certainly have to get rid of that one. You certainly have to get rid of that one. One of the things whenever I think of what this looks like, did you ever see the movie Harvey with Jimmy Stewart and the big rabbit was his friend, the invisible rabbit that nobody else could see? And he just talked to the rabbit wherever he was going. Well, Harvey, here we are at the doctor's office, and you know, two of them are sitting there. And he's just having this wonderful conversation, and he goes through life, and he's never separated from his buddy Harvey, this six-foot rabbit. And, of course, it's easy to make fun of somebody like that. Look at them. They think there's a rabbit. They think there's, well, people will make fun of people who rely on God. There are places, I'm sure, where you feel like, well, in this crowd, I'm not going to mention the word God, because they give me a hard time and they do this and that. Why not? Eventually, we have to get comfortable to tell the truth no matter where we are. And when you do, you may get some wise guy say something, oh, yeah, well, that's a bunch of junk, you know, you fanatics, you, and all those things. On the other hand, you may have someone come up and say, I've got a drinking problem, and you seem so comfortable and happy. Could I talk to you for a while? I'm so glad that you've had the courage to say that. And so here we are. And the 10th step in both the big book and the 12 and 12. I'm a type of sponsor who uses both books. And I realize that there are places where the 12 and 12 is, don't mention it here. We have a club in Tampa. Don't mention the 12 and 12 in that club. Who knows why that it fell out of favor? I think it goes all the way back to 1952 when the 12 and 12 came out. And people who were already in AA 10 years said, what the Bill writing that for? I can see the traditions, but we don't need anything more about the steps. It's all in the big book. I'm doing great in the big book. He's just causing confusion. He just has a big ego. He wants to write blah, blah, blah. So I tell the people I sponsor, don't read the 12 and 12. That's 1950. That's 60 years later. And it's been passed down from one sponsor to another. don't read the 12 and 12. So people have not read it and don't like it. It's a little contempt prior to investigation, I think. As I go through there, there's places where I think the big book, step two, for example, the big book is so superior to the 12 and 12. I mean, it's just not even close. That's one of the great chapters that we have is the chapter of the agnostic. And then step 10, they're equal. They both have such powerful ideas for us to incorporate the world of the spirit and daily reprieve, contingent on our spiritual condition. These are words that are quoted year after year throughout AA because of their power. When you read that at a meeting and you watch the room, you know that the reason people are connecting is because it's pure truth. We do have a daily reprieve, contingent on our spiritual condition. The alcohol problem has been removed. Not solved. There's a big difference between removing and solving. We don't need an explanation for anything if it's gone. And then over in the 12 and 12, the spiritual axiom. Oh my God! That got me thinking. If something disturbed me, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. As soon as I read that, I said, "Oh no." I'm going to pick this thing apart. This has got loopholes in it. This thing couldn't possibly be true. Any of you feel the same way? There's something wrong with me. But what about, you know, justifiable anger? This guy did that. I didn't do anything. I was just sitting there. And he goes, so what's wrong with me? You're disturbed. Oh. Yeah, I am. Well, that's what's wrong with you. And you should not move through the rest of the day until you get undisturbed. Because otherwise, you're going to be a lot of bad things happen if you stay disturbed. You're going to yell at your boss. You're going to say something to your girlfriend. You're going to do this. You're going to get in a traffic situation. All because you're so furious, even though we all agree, none of it's your fault. And then you go, yeah, well, I agree with that. None of it is my fault. But what am I supposed to do about my boss that embarrassed me in front of all the other workers? What am I supposed to do about him? It was 100% his fault. My sponsor said it's 100% his fault. So, forgive him. Oh, no, I'm not into forgiving. That's not, but that's how you get undisturbed. Isn't it fun? Do you want to be undisturbed or do you want to keep your boss on the hot plate? And eventually we see the wisdom in that step in the 12 and 12. And then, of course, if it's our fault, we make amends. The whole point being to get undisturbed again. Does anybody here in the room have a problem that's not bothering you? No, right? So, if we took action and it stopped bothering you, is it still a problem? You were grossly insulted in front of all the people, but it's not bothering you. Is it a problem? No. That's called spiritually lifting yourself away from these problems. And it's not the way the material world works. So we have to learn spiritual practices that are laid out, and especially in the 10th step, because that's our day at a time step. That's how to live in the now. That's how to live just for today. And, you know, totally relying on God, Keeping God Present. Brother Lawrence's book, Practicing the Presence. If you're new and you never heard of this, it's a little thin book. It was written 500 years ago by a brother, not even a monk. He was wasn't educated enough to be a monk. And so he was just the brother, and he repaired shoes. He cleaned up stuff in the kitchen. And he wrote to other people who were troubled, like nuns and brothers and monks, in letters. And these letters are so simple and so comforting, and it's all called Practicing the Presence, which is what the world of the Spirit is all about, is how can I practice the presence? How can I have Harvey the Rabbit with me? How can I walk hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe? How can I not let the events of the material day overpower me and bury me? How can I watch the freaking news and stay sane? Do you follow what I'm saying? How? So then we find things. Certainly the 10th step in Big Book and 12 and 12, just you should just learn it till it becomes part of you. Because it'll pay dividends forever by adopting these forgiveness. One of the great, most underused tool in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, is forgiveness. We just don't get to discuss it enough, and we don't incorporate it into our lives enough. People have asked me, what would you recommend if you wanted to increase the forgiveness inside of ourselves? And like the third step, which begins, made a decision to turn on. Decisions are very powerful things. You make a decision that you're going to be a forgiving person. You just do that. You just say to yourself, I am going to become a forgiving person. It's going to be part of my nature. In other words, take the action before the situation comes along that you are going to use forgiveness on. In other words, this is done while you're calm and you're thinking about, I want to become a forgiving person. I am going to forgive. Forgiveness is going to be part of me. And then just watch if you can make it part of you so the next time at work something happens and you feel, wait a minute, I'm a forgiving person now. I'm letting this gal off the hook. And you realize what you just did. The power of forgiveness is most powerful when you do it as the event is happening. Do you see the difference? You don't even let the event stay around long enough so that you judge it. You just go, no, this one I'm letting go. I'm forgiving. Forgiving. It is very, very powerful. And I remember my sponsor, I don't know how I got off on this. Well, we got plenty of time. So. There's no ending to the topic anyway. The first time I heard it, and some of you have heard this story, I'm in the Marine Corps. We're both in the Marine Corps. We're down in Quantico. I've gotten out of the nut ward. I'm back on active duty. And I'm doing a halfway decent job. And some guy at work borrows $10 from me. I didn't know he was being transferred. 3 days later, he's in California at his new duty station with my $10. And I go to my sponsor and I go, this guy owed me $10. He knew he was getting transferred. He borrowed the money and he's gone. What the hell? You know, I get a lawyer out in California. And he said, why don't you forgive him? You know, he made a mistake. He's a jerk. He just forgive him. Just let him off the hook. Just say, gone. I said, why should I do that? So you won't be angry all the time. You won't be thinking about it all the time. You won't be talking about it all the time. Just let it go. And you know something? I went, yeah. And you know, it felt great. I was just going, that is cool. Now, about 40 months later, something similar happened, only the amount was $40. Now, that's not even close. $40 in the 60s was a lot of money. So I'm talking to him, and you know, and he says, well, why don't you just forgive him? I said, 40 bucks is not 10. 40 is a whole new level. And so we're having this discussion about how far should forgiveness go? Yeah, that was my question, because I could see he keeps pushing me. Next, it'll be 60. Forgive him, you know. And I said, well, how far does forgiveness go, Bill? Just out of curiosity. He said, well, I don't know, but I do know there was this man one time who was being nailed to a cross and killed. And he said, forgive them, they know not what they do. So if you run into something that's worse than being nailed to the cross and killed, come on back and we'll talk about it. I think I got the message that there's no limit to forgiveness. There's no limit to forgiveness. So if we decide to become a forgiving person, then don't set a limit on it. You are going to forgive and fill in the blanks. And you know, 3 years ago when my daughter was murdered, I was able to apply that the instant that I found out, because I had seen someone else do it. And it led to all you suffer then is the loss, but you don't suffer anger, hatred, resentment, revenge, all of those horrible things that come with that. They're gone. God takes those away. And you're just left with sorrow, which he helps you with. So this is not a theory. I'm telling you, this is very, but it requires deciding ahead of time to become a forgiving person. That's you from now on. That's who you are. And I think it's one of the ways we could improve our level of forgiveness in AA. It's just we don't do it. We don't take advantage of it, and we suffer because of it. Because if we don't, we're left with all this pain and anger and this is unfair. That was the other thing, my sponsor, unfair. And he said, Sandy, let's discuss that. He got a lot of stuff out in the first couple of years. Fairness is a one-way street. It only goes out from you. That's the end of the discussion. I said, well, what about it? He said, no, you just be fair and let everything else go. Don't keep track of whether it was fair to you. It's fairness is a one-way street. Just be fair, and you will be very happy. I didn't like any of these things. But they're all part of the spiritual world. We have entered the world of the Spirit. And, of course, you can see that if you can implement these various things that I'm talking about, you are much less disturbed. Year in and year out, you experience one-tenth of the stress that you would have experienced as the events, because the events happen to all of us. There's unfair things, and, you know, I'm retired, and I have a monthly income that lets me eat out a lot. I love eating out. And then my friends in meetings, one after another, are losing jobs. And it's really hard. And so we try to help them find a job. We try to help them a little bit financially. But mostly we try to show them how to spiritually go through this so that it isn't bothering them. It's not bothering them. To me, that's the art of spirituality. Is things don't bother you that used to bother you. And when you see that in yourself, you realize what a gift you've been given, because you're going to be doing this for the rest of your life. Just look at the amount of stress you're not going to experience if you become a forgiver and a walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And these things, this is the real AA. It is a gift that is worth millions. And it's worth talking about. It's worth thinking about and incorporating into your own life. Sometimes when we're new, we think sobriety is the name of the game. And it really isn't. That's how we stay alive, is by not drinking. But that's not the goal. I mean, if you wanted to just stay sober, if that's your goal, punch your cop. You'll have 30 days sobriety before you know it. It's just, that's not what we're talking about. Now, if you're new, I'm sure, this would sound like a trick question. What is the point of AA? The point of AA is a spiritual awakening. And it's in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So the whole point is to have this awakening, you to have it. And I remember going, well, I didn't want anything to do with spirituality. I didn't want anything, Bill's going, look, you have a disease that only a spiritual experience can conquer. I don't believe in spiritual experiences. Well, you're screwed. Because we don't have a non-spiritual way for real alcoholics to stay alive. And I said, what am I going to do? He said, change your mind. Change your mind. I went, change my mind? I don't do that. That's not. And he said, yeah, we know. We can see. You don't change your mind. Whoa. And changing our mind, another spiritual principle. It's another freedom. It's one of the greatest things in the world. And in the beginning, the first time a self-centered alcoholic changes his or her mind, it looks like the Queen Mary being turned around in a small harbor. There's 9 tugboats. Oh, I just changed my mind. Look. When you change your mind, you were set free of something that was not true. It isn't the things you don't know that hurt you. It's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And so we have a lot of old ideas that are not true. But we think they are. We file them away, our perception. And as we work on letting go of ideas, which means that I'm going to say I'm wrong. Well, I was wrong about my childhood. I was wrong about those kids in grammar school. I was wrong about that deal in high school. Please, I was wrong about this. I was wrong about that. Chuck Chamberlain loved to be wrong. He was one of my heroes, my spiritual heroes. I was very lucky to meet him a few times and go to his house, sit in his chair, overlooking the Pacific. And he just loved to find something else he was wrong about so he could throw it away, so he could just discard it. Goodbye. And just be left with truth. You see, the more you get rid of ideas that aren't true, the more you're left with truth. It's what gets left behind. It's there. But it's disguised with a million things that aren't true. So spiritual growth is done by getting rid of things. Isn't that amazing? It's done by getting rid of things. Oh, throw it away, throw it away, throw it away. It's like riding in a balloon. If you throw the weight over, it goes higher and you get a better view and it becomes more exciting. So let me see. Wow, that's enough of that. I I'm going to shift over and talk about a couple other things. And the reason I'm doing this is I could just go on and on and on and on about this stuff, but you can't retain all that, so what the hell, that's enough. So I'll tell you something that I'm really happy about, that I'm very excited about. About 2 years ago, myself and three other people started what we call a spillover meeting. In other words, our home group, or the group we were going to, got so crowded people were sitting on the floor. And there was nothing we could do about the space, so some of us went somewhere else and started another meeting. But it was people who we knew and all that, and we call that whatever, spillover meeting or whatever. And this one had about six of us. And it was a discussion meeting, and we went around, and we'd get the meeting wrapped up in 40 minutes, and we had 20 minutes of free time at the end. But you can't leave early because somebody might come to your meeting. So we said, let's have each week one of us will talk 15 minutes on a topic, and then we'll all comment, and we could use up the hour. Does that make sense? So the first person who comes in talks about Sister Ignatia. And we're going, no, like a tradition, like a... one of the steps, the spiritual life is not a theory, whatever. Well, everybody liked Sister Ignatia. They had printed it off the internet, and they had handouts, and they're talking about it. And the next person talked about the Rockefeller dinner. They had the menu, and they brought it to the meeting. So we decided to leave it alone and turn it into a history meeting. And then each week, people would come up with a topic, and you could have only 3 months and go on. There's certain sites that are filled with history things, and a newcomer was really excited. They're coming in, they had all this stuff prepared, and there was old-timers there that could flesh out the stuff that was discussed. And then we decided to do a book study, and that's when it's gotten very exciting, and most people will agree that the best history book written about AA was written by a Harvard student who was getting a PhD, and he got his PhD in AA. He did a PhD on AA, and his name was Kurtz, and the name of the book is Not God. And the footnotes alone half the book because of the research that you do for a PhD. And the New York office gave him access to everything. So now we have an author, a researcher, who has access to everything and who is very objective. You know, if you write your own history, I don't know about you guys, but I might leave a few things out that were embarrassing. I'm not saying AA would leave things out that Ernie Kurtz found. But anyway, that's the book we're studying. And recently, and I just want to give you a flavor of this. Recently, we came to this part in the AA story. And it's 1940. And Bill and Lois have been thrown out of the townhouse in New York. And they have borrowed cars and lived in 60 or 70 AA members' homes over the next two-year period. And the AA was taking up small collections to give him $20 a week to live on so that he could keep starting AA. So in other words, his life was not spectacular. The big book wasn't selling. And they were trying to get publicity for AA. This was the period that they call publicity. And Clarence Snyder was able to get the Cleveland Plain Dealer to write some articles about a sermon that a minister gave, and the minister told Clarence's story in the sermon without breaking his anonymity. And that got some coverage in the newspaper about AA. Then the Liberty Magazine article, which was very religious, but it got a few things. And the Gabriel Heater radio show, where this was a very popular show, and they had human interest on it. And in New York, they had an Irishman named Morgan Ryan, who had very questionable sobriety. He was sober one week and gone the next. But he knew Gabriel Heater, and he talked to him, and he said, Gabriel Heater said he'll talk to me on the radio. And Bill said, and you'll mention the big book, which is just coming out. And he said, yeah, I'll mention the big book. Well, they didn't trust Morgan, so they put him in the YMCA with a round-the-clock AA guard for a week until he appeared on the Gabriel Heater show, and then they sent out the postcards and all that, and they got three orders. After all that, they canvassed doctors. They thought that would be good people to send postcards. Sure cure for alcoholism. Listen to the Gabriel Heater show. Buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got three orders. But what really brought in a bunch of orders was a baseball player. And some of you may have heard of Bob Feller, Cleveland Indians. Back then, he was one of the first players to throw 100 miles an hour, young 19-year-old, but he needed a mature catcher to control him. And the catcher was named Raleigh Helmsley, but Raleigh was a big drunk. He was a good catcher, but he was drunk a lot, and he drank so much that reporters not only covered him during the game, they went out with him after the game, because there was generally a very exciting story that was going to unfold that night as Raleigh set fire to a bar or got arrested again and all that. So he was well known as Mr. Excitement. All of a sudden, he's playing perfect ball, error-free. And Bob Feller is setting records, pitched a perfect game. And the sports writers are going to Raleigh going, Raleigh, what's going on here? He said, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober, and I'm hitting, and I'm doing wonderful. And so all of the newspapers in the country, in the sports section, gave AA a big plug all over Raleigh Helmsley breaking his anonymity. Now, the anonymity was part of us, but it hadn't been hammered home like it is today. And when Bill saw what happened with something like 800 inquiries at the New York office because of Helmsley breaking his anonymity, Bill started breaking his anonymity. And he started going around from different cities and getting interviews with reporters and putting his picture in the paper. And some of the old-timers, people with 3 years, went up to Bill and said, hey, Bill, this is, you're on a dry drunk. It's where the term dry drunk came from. They went after Bill for his ego was getting out of whack here. And, but he kept it up. And he enjoyed the tension. And he had the feeling that his thoughts were getting superior and clearer than they used to be. And that was followed by the worst depression that he ever felt. He just came crashing down off of that episode. And he and Lois were living in two rooms over the clubhouse in New York. And these were little rooms with crummy little furniture. And he's sitting in there totally despondent. You know, people are not staying sober. The people in Cleveland are giving him a hard time. Hank Parker's got drunk and went up there and started all these bad rumors about him. When the janitor came up and said, there's a guy downstairs that wants to see you. Bill said, geez, another drunk. I don't feel like talking to him, but maybe I'd better. And this guy comes up, and it's a rainy night, and he traveled all the way from St. Louis. And Bill looked at him, and he had kind of an old coat on, a hat. And when he took the coat back, he saw the Roman collar. He realized it was a priest, and it was Father Dowling, who came all the way from St. Louis. Because when he read the 12 steps, Father Dowling was a Jesuit priest, and to him, the 12 step looked like the practices of St. Ignatius, which the Jesuits followed. And he wanted to see, who was this man and what is this? And he walks into Bill's life, and Bill's at the absolute bottom. And all of a sudden, Bill describes it. He said, all the light in the room went to this man's face. And he suddenly felt hope again. And the priest started talking to him about what spirituality was and how important it was that Bill keep up his work. And Bill said, and this is a very important thing that happened. He said, is there never any peace? And Dowling slammed his fist down and said, no, never. And he explained to him divine discontent. That on a spiritual path, we will always be dissatisfied with our present condition, which drives us forward until God's will becomes apparent to us. And this explanation meant so much to Bill that Father Dowling became his sponsor. Ebby is the sponsor he talks about, but the one who Bill went to for the rest of his time was always Father Dowling to get feedback. And when I read that whole paragraph in there, I saw where all of the material for step 7 in the 12 and 12 came from. Because that's a remarkable transformation from the big book, is step 6 and 7 in the 12 and 12. And it all came from expanding our horizon to being dissatisfied but keep on going. And Bill found out that his greatest problem was the demands that he put on life. And if you recall in there, he said, we have to find a way of reducing our demands, and that's done spiritually. And as you can do that. So this paragraph was just so moving as we read that. And I'm just bringing it up because if it ever occurs to you to start a history meeting, I think you'll be glad that you did. Now, the last thing, and then I don't know how much time we want. We're supposed to stay here till 5. Okay, this is just 4 or 5 minutes. This is a problem that AA is going to have to continue to deal with. And it goes like this. When I came into AA in the 60s, America was a different country than it is today. And so the cross-section of people that were coming in was greatly different than it is now. Most of the people who came in were churchgoers. And so there was very great comfort in talking about God and talking about this. And most of the meetings were in church basements. There was great cooperation between the minister and the AA group, and the group anniversary, the minister would come in and say a few kind words to the AA group, and there was all this. Now, you fast forward to today, and you'll find that the intellectuals in our country are almost all atheists, and that the professors in our universities, there's a whole class that has shown that the mysteries of the universe can be explained by science and we don't need God anymore. This was just starting in the 20s and 30s when Bill was coming, just starting up. But it became a very huge thing. So we have a lot of newcomers who are coming in here. If I think I had a problem with God because I've got messed up with the church, these people have a serious struggle intellectually with even saying the word. They're worried that their classmates find out that they said the word God and they'll be laughed out of their class. So it's a different problem that we had. And so we find a resistance to our steps, to our big book, to the 12 and 12, to the whole program as it is outlined. And the question is, how do we accommodate this new energy? And the solution that appears to be developing is we're going to end up with two AAs, one with God and one without. And I think that that's a shame that it's going that way, and that we should spend more time thinking through and explaining how the word God is used in AA. Not what it means, but how it's used. And as they come into your home group and you're talking with them, you might use things like this. I understand what you said. It upsets you when I talk about God all the time. Is that right? Yes, it does. It just gets me upset. Perhaps you're upset because you're deciding for me what I mean when I use the word. You're deciding for me. You never asked me. And yet you're upset with the word, but you don't know how I use the word. So maybe if I told you, it would comfort you a little bit. The word has no meaning. There is no meaning. There's no AA God. It is a word that was an obvious choice to describe an experience. You see, as we work these steps with an open mind, we have something amazing take place inside of ourselves. And we have to explain it to ourselves. What the hell just happened to me? And most of us go, so this is the God they're talking about. And the only connection we have to the word is, it's what caused the experience that I had. That's the end of it. And you've either had the experience or you haven't had the experience. If you keep an open mind, you could have this experience, and then you would be stuck explaining what caused it. And something like that might keep people here long enough to try so that they have the same experience that we had. Because it may be possible through strong cohesiveness, and not everybody is alcoholic of our type, for people to achieve raw sobriety on just some meetings and discussions and talk about the universe. But that's a far cry from a spiritual awakening. And I just hate to see that could be lost. So you have to decide if somebody comes to your group and says, I don't think I could stay here unless you get rid of the Lord's Prayer. You have to really think that through. Part of us would go, well, gee, we want to be nice. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Maybe we ought to accommodate them. It's not the end of the world. We'll just go, vroom, vroom, vroom. But then we have to think it through. The point of the program is to give us the power to adjust to the world as it is and not to encourage someone to demand the world adjust to them. We have taught that person the exact opposite of a spiritual lesson by being nice to him. We can kill people with niceness. And so it has to be seen that way, that yes, it would be polite, it would be accommodating, but it could also teach a terrible lesson that, what else don't you like? Well, I don't like making amends. Don't worry, we'll skip that. Do you see where I'm going? We'll go there. So anyway, here's my challenge to you guys from Atlanta. while we're talking about prayer. The International is going to be here in 2015. Right? Right? In 2010, in San Antonio, whoever it was decided to end the spiritual meeting on Sunday morning with no prayers. Do you guys think you can somehow cause it to turn out where we say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the International in Atlanta? Good luck. Anyway, that's just my challenge, and I think we've been here long enough. I was going to have a few questions, but it's 4:45, and I'm tired, and I'm sure you all are, so let's wrap it up, and thank you all very much. You got it?